Welcome back to another episode of the Legendary Life Podcast. I'm your host, Ted Rice, and this is the show that's all about taking your health, body, and life to that next level. Before I get to today's interview, I want to tell you that today is the last day you can get the Black Friday / Cyber Monday sale. We have our workouts 75% off. So if you go to legendarylifepodcast.com, you can check out the workouts there. These are the same workouts that have been tested over the past 7 months now in the CO Strength coaching program, as well as all the people who have bought the programs and benefited from them. So today's your last chance. Cyber Monday, go to legendarylifepodcast.com and check out what we have going on. On to today's interview, I have a great guest. His name is Dr. Brad Dieter. Not only is he a doctor, a PhD, who's done research on epigenetics and metabolic disease, and I'll let him explain all the details of what he does, but he's also a great guy, and he's also an athlete, a coach. He's a person who is both grounded in academia and in what we call the real world. I love Dr. Brad Dieter's approach to things because he's a guy, he'll tell you he wanted to go into medicine, what's called allopathic medicine, which is the traditional doctors, the traditional realm of medicine that we're all familiar with when we go to the doctor and get our physical. However, he got disillusioned with that and went down this route of trying to discover what creates optimal health and looking into things like exercise, like nutrition, like supplementation. And he's here today to clear up some misinformation that we get thrown at us all the time in the health and fitness industry, or I'm in the health and fitness industry, and I get it thrown at me all the time. But you, as a consumer of health and fitness information, isn't it tough out there trying to figure out what's real, who to listen to? And man, that marketing sounds so convincing. Well, he's here to clear a lot of that up. We're going to dive into what the science says and also what he feels is important based on, you know, these two paths that he walks, the one in the research world, the one in the real world, where Brad's a guy who puts all this into play in his own life. And if you want to check out his information, go to sciencedrivennutrition.com. And you can check out articles about all different aspects of nutrition. He dives into some controversial topics to help clear things up for people so they make better decisions to focus on what really matters the most and to get away from the controversy and the hype out there. He's also the head science guy over at eat2perform.com. So you may want to check that out as well. So I'll shut up. Let's get to the interview with Dr. Brad Dieter. Dr. Brad Dieter, welcome to the Legendary Life Podcast.
Thanks, Ted. It's great to get on and finally record an episode with you. I know you and I have chatted a few times, so this is I'm excited for this conversation. It'll be a blast.
Yeah, it's always fun when we get to connect beforehand and talk about some things and feel each other out. So it's not just like, okay, you're a person, I'm a person, we don't know each other, let's try to make some magic. It's always better when that happens.
Yeah, the awkward first date is what I like to call it.
Exactly. That's a perfect analogy, you know?
Yep.
But you got to at least buy me either a paleo red wine or, you know, some gluten-free beer for me to let you get to first base, Brad.
That's fair enough.
Actually, I'm just making that joke because Brad and I were joking about some things earlier, and we're going to get to that. But Brad, I want you to introduce yourself for the listeners so people know about all your accolades and academic achievements. So talk a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Yeah, so I guess I'll kind of let you know where I'm at now and tell you how I got there. So a few years ago, I finished my PhD in exercise science, exercise physiology, and did a master's in biomechanics, exercise physiology. Before that, did undergrad, was kind of pre-med, and so have kind of gone the whole biological sciences route. But kind of all along the way, I've been an athlete and been a coach. And I've always tried to keep my feet in both the research world and in the applied world and the clinical space, because I think, You know, both worlds are so important. And so that's kind of my background a little bit. And so right now I'm doing a fellowship in basically metabolism and disease, specifically kind of organ complications that arise from, you know, diabetes and things like that. So that's kind of my resume summed up in a very short nutshell.
Yeah. You also said you do some research into molecular biology, into epigenetics, which as I'm sure you know, of course, gets thrown around all the time. Man, it's that epigenetics, man. That's what's
getting,
like, people just talk about it, but we're going to get the real deal from you, the truth from you. So how did you get into this? You said you've always been an athlete, but I'm always curious, like, what makes people take the path that they took to get to doing something like what you're doing now?
Yeah. So basically what happened is, growing up, I thought I wanted to be a doctor. And so when I got done with high school, realized that being 6 foot and white, my athletic prowess and my ability to make a lot of money being a professional basketball player probably wasn't going to pan out. So I decided to just focus on school. And somewhere along the way in undergrad, I realized, like, clinical medicine just wasn't for me, whether it was, you know, just there's a whole lot of stuff that people don't really see about being a clinician and being, you know, a doctor in a hospital, that after a lot of exposure to it, just realized it wasn't me. But I've been a nerd at heart since I was a little kid and blew stuff up in the kitchen. So decided to go the science route and kind of got a little bit, I think, probably disenfranchised with allopathic medicine for a while, and was like, how can I do medical research but from a different perspective? And so I decided I'd go the exercise physiology route and found a lab that basically what we did, or I'm kind of in my master's and also my PhD work, was we took models of disease, specifically diabetes, and we looked at how we know exercise is protective and kind of basically prevents us from, you know, getting a lot of the chronic diseases like heart disease, diabetes, is protective against Alzheimer's and stuff. So I decided to ask the question of, what the heck's going on? How does exercise do this stuff, right? We don't have any drugs that are that effective. I mean, you can spend millions of dollars on drugs and they don't do anything, but exercise prevents a lot of this stuff. So what is, like, the hardcore nerdy science biology of that piece? So that's what I spent probably a good 5 or 6 years doing, and that's kind of where I'm at now.
Well, man, before I ask you about that, what's the nerdiest thing you've ever done?
Oh, like, in my professional career, in my normal life, because I do a lot of nerdy stuff in my normal life too.
I don't think professional career counts if you got a PhD, because it's like, no, it's not nerdy stuff I'm doing.
Yeah.
This is work. So definitely personal. I used to play Dungeons and Dragons with dice. Oh, there you go.
Oh, boom. Yeah. Basically, I played so much Halo when I was in college that it would probably make you scream. Spent a lot of time doing stuff like that. I still to this day read sci-fi and fantasy books as much as possible. I probably read 30 or 40 big books a year. Now, that's kind of my unwind time. So I get pretty nerdy.
That's pretty nerdy. I aspire to that level of nerdiness. I've fallen off. I don't read much anymore, unfortunately, because I'm too busy working. But, you know, and I read really slow. That's really the reason. I'm a slow reader. Audible, there you go.
Yeah, I think I just finished like a 40-hour trilogy on Audible. So that's been, I did that like a couple of weeks. So that was pretty bad.
Cool, man. Well, let's dive into it, because you talked about you're spending so much time doing your research on diabetes. I'm going to frame what I put forth here on the show. Then I'd love to hear you critique it, but also fill in the missing details. So many people, this is the way I used to think, Brad. Mm-hmm. Okay, people are getting overweight. People are getting these diseases because it's modern life. We live in these apartments and live in these cities that are full of toxins that affect our endocrine system. We eat food that are full of chemicals that disrupts things and causes us to get fat. Even when we work out, our stress levels are so high, it can affect that. That's where I came from. And now I think, okay, and I think a lot of people are there now. I was there in maybe 2000, 2001, 2000, till about maybe, I don't know, 2005, seven, whenever it ended. now I'm thinking, okay, we are incredibly sedentary. We like to blame endocrine disrupting chemicals. We like to blame the evil food corporations that are putting too much high fructose corn syrup into our food and drinks. But it's really the fact that we're eating way too much, more than we think we do, because we're so disrupted. Our minds are so disrupted with our fast-paced modern life, and we just don't move. Even the people who work out 3-4 times a week in the gym are otherwise very sedentary. Fill in the blanks, critique it, you know, provide your PhD perspective for us to understand what's going on here.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing to acknowledge is that narrative arc that you painted of kind of your understanding is, I would say, probably the most accurate description of most people's thought process and their evolution, right? If you kind of go to this, I went through a very similar kind of thought process, right? You're like, okay, it's got to be these things that are causing all this. But when you really kind of step back and you look at it is, you know, those things you mentioned of, you know, toxins, you know, we blame things like BPA, then we blame things like specific nutrients and all sorts of stuff. And those are all, when you kind of look at all the science, you kind of dive into all the literature, the endocrine literature, the physical activity literature, the obesity literature, those are all pieces. But the two primary driving factors are, the first thing, if you really look at it, is the physical activity piece. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. The other piece is the food environment piece. When you really look at the collective food environment, that's really what dictates a lot of the overconsumption. You talked a little bit about we eat more than we think we do. And that's a huge piece because, I mean, you're basically living in an environment of hyperpalatable foods that we overconsume, foods that are extremely energy dense, that are super ready. And the easier foods to eat are always the more calorie dense foods. So those are two pieces. But the physical activity piece, you know, you just kind of mentioned, oh, okay, someone who goes to the gym 3 to 4 days a week, they're, you know, still gaining weight. Well, if you kind of look at the way the human body's designed and how metabolism works, is exercising 3 to 4 times a week for an hour, I mean, really doesn't do a dang thing for weight loss or calorie expenditure or anything like that, right? 3 to 4 days a week, you know, let's say you spend an hour at a time, you're working out fairly hard, you know, that's maybe 900 to 1200 calories a week you're burning in your exercise. And that really doesn't amount to much. It's really just the low levels of physical activity, the walking around, the manual labor, da 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 da. I mean, if you kind of look at, I mean, probably your job and my job that's more intellectual, service-based, is a lot of it is just incredibly sedentary. I mean, it's easy to spend 10 hours a day at your desk and you haven't done a darn thing. And that's really one of the key pieces.
You know what I said the other day, Brad? I thought it was really funny when I was thinking about it. I had this epiphany. The most exercise that sedentary people get is probably washing themselves in the shower and brushing their teeth.
You know what? That's actually a very salient point, right? That is, for some people, the peak of their physical activity during the day.
Not good.
It's kind of mind-blowing. You know, when you really think about it, is we've got all of this literature to support movement. I mean, it doesn't even have to be exercise. It just has to be like walking around, and we don't do any of it. I mean, we get up, we maybe walk downstairs to the kitchen to make a cup of coffee. You shower, you brush your teeth, you drive to work, you walk into work, you sit at your desk, you go home. I mean, that accumulates over the span of a decade, and all of a sudden you have a decade of a physical body that has had no stimulus to adapt in a positive way.
Yeah. And Brad, what's the answer there? Because I'll tell you this, we had this great success story. A guy in our coaching group has lost, at first it was 16 pounds and 18 pounds and 22 pounds, and it happened pretty fast. And I was like, what the hell are you doing, man? Like, everyone else is getting results, but you're just really killing it. And I was like, is everything okay? Like, do you feel okay? Or you're not starving yourself? He's like, no, you know what I'm doing? I looked at his stats. He's getting in 15,000 to 20,000 steps almost every single day, in addition to working out four times a week. And I mean, what is the answer there to get? And I know it comes down to, okay, well, how many calories are you eating? How many calories you burning? But what is a good, good mark? Well, I'm trying to say measure. What is something that people listening? Yes, a benchmark.
Okay.
That people should shoot for.
Yeah. So I think, kind of before we give you a hard number, I think that's a perfect case study to highlight one of the principles that is really undervalued is when we talk about kind of human metabolism, is it's really easy to break it down into probably three main contributors of what kind of dictates your total energy expenditure in a day. One is just your basal metabolic rate, right? If I were to lay on the couch and watch the entire series of Stranger Things in a day, which I recommend to people, because that's a great way to spend a Sunday. So if you just lay on the couch, don't do anything, you've got, just to survive, to think, to breathe, to do whatever, you've got a basal metabolic rate. So that just adds a specific amount. Now, the next piece that adds the most to that calorie expenditure is what we call your non-exercise activity. So that's things like walking, right? Doing chores, anything that's basically physical activity, but it's not exercise. And then probably the last piece that actually makes any significant contribution is exercise. Now, if you kind of take that person, that case study you had, and you compared that 15,000 to 20,000 steps a day of a calorie expenditure versus his, let's say, hour-long super hard workout, that non-exercise activity or just the walking is probably going to be 4 to 5 times more in terms of how many calories he expends than his 1 hour he spent hammering it in the gym. So a lot of times when you've got people who are just looking to lose weight, is I say spend more time walking and less time in the gym, because that's really what kind of adds up that calorie expenditure. So a good benchmark, it really depends on each person and their goal, but you know, the 10,000 kind of steps a day is what's kind of standardized in a lot of the scientific literature to show that it can actually, you know, reflect a lot of benefit to people. Something like a jump between 10,000 and 15,000 makes a way bigger difference for somebody than adding an extra day in at the gym.
Yeah. I hope you're listening right now and had a perspective shift. Maybe stop going to that high intensity interval training group class that you love to go to because you feel you lay down on the ground and talk about how hard of a workout it is and make sweat angels, and just make sure that you're hitting 10, 15, maybe even up to 20,000 steps a day of just walking, light activity. That's awesome, Brad.
Yeah. And I think too, a lot of times, you know, we live in a high stress environment, right? And I think a lot of times people who are trying to lose weight actually benefit from more low intensity, low stress stuff than they do on an additional, you know, essential stressor. Now there's people who are athletes who, you know, need that kind of high intensity work to get better at their sport. But if you're somebody who's kind of into more of the fat loss, look good naked approaches, a lot of times the lower intensity piece is going to give you a lot more benefit than that 1 hour workout.
Yeah. You know, I just had a bit of epiphany. I'm going to go back and change some of the things I'm doing with the coaching group based on that. Brad, I want to get into something that people say a lot, and I love to get into the food environment thing more, because I think that's a very technically sounding term. I think it's just brilliance there. But before we do that, I would love to hear your perspective. I've had someone, or probably a couple people on here, say, oh, it's not calories that's causing the problem, it's hormones. And they weren't just talking about the insulin hypothesis, which is just eating so many carbs, it spikes your insulin, makes you store fat more than usual. They were talking about growth hormone. They were talking about testosterone. What do you have to say about that, about hormones as we get older? I mean, what's the story there?
The hormones are kind of a complicated piece. I think a lot of times people place way too much emphasis on them than needs to be, right? There's a lot of people who will talk, you know, a lot about, oh, you have high cortisol, you're not going to be able to lose weight, or your testosterone's a little bit low, you're not going to be able to lose weight, or your growth hormone levels are off, so you're not going to be able to lose weight. I think that is one of the intellectual traps we fall in as coaches. And I think it's one of those things where the way I view it is your body has all these things. You've got cortisol, you've got insulin, you've got leptin, you've got ghrelin, you've got all these hormones. And they're all basically, I mean, think about like a a mixing board, right? You've got all these knobs and levers and stuff that kind of dictate stuff.
Sure.
Each of those is just kind of a small knob that can play a role in your body's ability to kind of build muscle tissue or lose fat. It might make it a little bit harder for some people, a little bit easier for other people, and you've got genetics. But those are all just small knobs, and they fall kind of under the umbrella of all the really key basic concepts. And so I think a lot of times people overplay those things because it's easy to write a book about, it's easy to sell a program about, it's a sexier sounding term, and it's kind of more of the hack quick fix approach than it is addressing real systemic issues.
Yeah, I hear you on that. I do want to ask you though, to dive a bit deeper. And by the way, I used to feel like the other way, like, no, it's just hormones. It's just, you know, and I had no idea what I was talking about too, but later learned that it's a hormone system is really intricate. So be careful when you listen to fitness professionals talk about it. So what about people with a thyroid problem? They went to the doctor, the thyroid was a little bit low. I mean, and you said they're just small knobs, but is there any sort of, barring like a full-blown hormonal endocrine disease of some sort, I mean, is there things that can sabotage our progress?
Yeah, so there's few hormones that have a much bigger knob in terms of the effect that they have on your body's ability to kind of lose body weight and body fat. And thyroid's one of the big ones, at least, because that's kind of it regulates out of that basal metabolic rate. So if you have low thyroid, your basal metabolic rate is fairly low. Now there's kind of the idea of how low is it? If it's a little bit low, you're probably not going to notice anything. But if you're, you know, really clinically low, like if you need to have thyroid replacement drugs, then that's really going to make an effect on your body's ability to lose body weight and body fat. So thyroid is a big one. Female hormones, like if your estrogen levels are way off, that's another one that can add some complications. And if you're a man and then you have testosterone levels in like the single digits or the, you know, 10, 70, 120, those are also things that are bigger knobs, but they're not the things that are going to make or break stuff for you. Unless you do have some really clinical issues that you have to have replaced by a doctor.
So if you had, let's say, low thyroid and you say, oh, I can't lose weight because of my low thyroid, what they're really saying in a way is, okay, with how many calories I eat, with how much exercise I do, I can't lose weight with my current level of thyroid, and I would have to either up my exercise or dial back on the calories to make progress.
Yeah, but then I think one of the things too there, you kind of have to, that's where the art of the coaching comes in, right? Is if I've got a client who's got, you know, probably borderline to a little bit low thyroid and they're exercising 6 days a week and they're eating 1400 calories and they're not losing weight, you know, that tells me dieting down is just going to lower their thyroid level even more. Cause we know that super low calorie diets for a long time really kind of mess up the thyroid levels. So then what you do is you kind of say, okay, let's visit a clinician. Let's talk about bringing the calorie levels back up and trying to do some other things. So those are kind of the nuances where if you've got somebody who's kind of stuck and the eat less, do more hasn't worked and they've got some low thyroid levels, then you start to get the idea, okay, thyroid's obviously an issue here for this person. We need to address it clinically. We might need to dial back on the calorie restriction and the exercise and kind of bring that part of the endocrine system back into normal function.
Right. So if you're listening right now, make sure that you just get a hormonal panel. I mean, is that what you would recommend? What should we do to make sure there's not something hidden in our hormones or somewhere else that's sabotaging our 6 day high frequency workout routine and calorie restricted diet?
Yeah, that's what I tell people. So most people, if you're a relatively young, healthy person, and I use the term young, you know, fairly loosely, there's a broad range of young, in my opinion. If you're basically doing all the things right and you're making good progress kind of as expected, you don't need to do a hormone panel. But if you're somebody who's, you know, just is stuck and is not getting results, a hormone panel is super helpful. And it can give you a lot of insights into maybe why things aren't going the way that they're going. But I think the number of people who have those key issues that are not going to, that are keeping you from getting where you want to be is a small subset. And I think we've kind of, as an industry, basically the past probably 5-10 years have kind of sent the message that everybody's broken and everybody has this disorder or that disorder or something. And so everybody is kind of starting to get this mentality of, oh, something's really wrong with me. When a vast majority of people, that's just not the case.
Yeah, no, as it actually is. So pay me your money and I'll fix you. I have the answer. Guru Ted, yeah, at your service.
We'll order a $1,000 blood test before we even get going on anything.
Yeah, and we'll get into that because Brad and I were talking about, okay, well, we have a mutual acquaintance who is kind of on the edges, and I'm not going to name any names because I like the guy and I'm not completely sure. Anyway, what I'm getting at is that I asked Brad about the frontiers. What about the frontiers that maybe are on the fringe a little bit, but may have some scientific basis? We'll get into that later, but I'd love to hear more about the food environment that you spoke about before. Can you talk more about what that is and how it may be affecting people's behavior, eating behavior, without them really realizing it?
Yeah. So I guess those are kind of two separate questions. One is kind of unknown frontiers and the other is the food environment. So
we'll get to the frontiers later.
I'll start with the food environment. So there's kind of two pieces to it. And one is, the first one's kind of a little bit more straightforward, is when you look at basically how our entire environment is set up with food, is it's not really designed for us to do a very good job of regulating our own intake, right? If you go to the grocery store, I mean, most of the foods are very calorie dense, processed, designed to be overconsumed, and they're quick and easy and convenient. And so that's kind of the perfect storm of, here, let me give you some fairly nutrient poor, fairly energy dense, convenient, and easy to overconsume foods that you're going to make the staples of your diet. And that really just kind of sets you up for a not very good way of controlling your own calorie intake. That's just by behaviors and just by design, right? You go into the store, you shop, you buy these things, and all of a sudden now that's your just standard level of food intake. That's probably one of the best ways to describe the food environment, kind of conflicting with our ability to kind of regulate calories and regulate food consumption. One of the other things too, that this was something I didn't appreciate until I experienced it. So we hear a lot about things, you know, if you kind of look at the, what we call obesity and diabetes belt of America, which is kind of, you know, south, southwest, all the way through the southeast and kind of up that southern east corridor and kind of the Midwest, where obesity rates are 35-40%, diabetes rates are anywhere from, you know, 9-14%, depending on the state. There's a lot of places where the environment of food, there is no real good food options. So my experience with this was I didn't really think the whole idea of a food desert existed, right? The idea that you can't just go to the store and buy salad and chicken and vegetables and whatever. I had to go to Indiana for a conference and was there for a week and kind of stopped at the grocery store to stock up on some essentials for the week. And I walked into the local grocery store and there was, this is not me exaggerating, there was one package of carrots, one head of lettuce, and four apples in the whole store.
No
way. The rest of it was, you know, canned goods, boxed goods, all sorts of stuff. Cause it was in kind of a little bit lower socioeconomic part of town. And that was just the food environment. So we do have these big issues of food environment not matching what's required for optimal health.
Wow. And food desert. I've never heard that term.
Yeah. So next time you're kind of like, you travel to a big city, just kind of walk around and ask yourself, you know, where's the local grocery store? Would I be able to stop there on a weekly basis and get some food? And for a lot of people who live in kind of these inner cities that don't have, you know, good markets around, it's just good food isn't an option. Dinner for them is, you know, they stop at the 7-Eleven, they grab a hot dog, a Coke, and a bag of chips. And that's just the food environment because that's what's available.
So if you're listening, think about your food environment. Think about, because you listen to this show, you know what the better choices are. Do you have them with easy access? Do you have those better choices with easy access? What type of food environment do you live in? I live in a pretty good food environment here in Miami Beach, although I don't think it's as good as a lot of people might think it is. Definitely not a lot of access to local produce like you would get in maybe like in LA or at this farmer's market I was at. But no, that's great. What about, you know, not to go back into the hormone thing, but I was listening to this talk by Dr. Evan Cotter, one of the researchers in University of Chicago, and she did some research on sleep and how sleep deprivation can make us more hungry, even though we don't need the calories. Also, there's stress eating. Can you talk a little bit about those other triggers that may cause us to be hungry and to eat, but not necessarily need the calories?
Yeah, so there's a lot of different ways that our natural hunger signals can be disrupted. One of the main ones is sleep, right? So that literature has been very well established. Lots of studies have been done, lots of different populations, lots of different settings. And if you have an inadequate amount of sleep or you've accumulated a sleep debt, one, there's kind of, and it kind of happens on two fronts, is your kind of your hormone levels that dictate some of your satiety levels. So things like ghrelin is one of the hunger hormones. That's definitely dysregulated in the direction of being prone to be more hunger. And the second is your ability to make good decisions, and your decision fatigue is a lot worse if you're underslept. So you're going to gravitate towards the easier, more convenient, usually more energy dense options than the kind of what we would call healthier options to eat. So it's kind of on two fronts, your decision making and your just natural hunger signals that are sent by the rest of your body are definitely disrupted during sleep.
Yeah, no, thanks for that explanation, because it's always another level when you get to sit down and talk to someone who is in well-read on all this stuff. By the way, Brad, you're a complete rock star, man. I love how you're able to break this down. And oh, it's important, because there's a lot of very brilliant people out there who can't communicate in a way that us lay people can understand. So I really appreciate you for that. Let's talk a little bit about the calories in, calories out, the food quantity versus food quality, because there are a lot of people. In fact, one of my personal training clients mentioned she was trying to follow this diet because she doesn't listen to me. Right. You know, she's like, no, I just use you for exercise. Yeah. Yep. No, you're not a guru. I listen to gurus. You're here at my house. Gurus don't get whatever. Anyway, but you know, she's a great lady, but I train her husband mostly, just started training her on the side. And she was like, well, I was following this diet and all he said was, you can eat anything you want, as much as you want, as long as it's whole food. So if you want to put coconut oil in your coffee, or if you want to eat a bunch of bananas or eat a bunch of nuts or 2 pounds of steak, it's all good because it's whole foods, and whole foods do something different to your body than, say, processed foods do. So can you talk a little bit about the quantity versus quality, because people get that mixed up, especially with things like the Twinkie diet. Guy loses a bunch of weight just eating Twinkies. Can you provide some perspective for that?
Yeah, I think this is one of those questions that's kind of been polarized when it, you know, doesn't need to be. I think those, you know, there's the Twinkie diet, the McDonald's diet, all those kind of things that have shown, you know, that coupled with the actual research that's been done really shows that the quantity of the food that you eat, so the calories, is really probably the biggest dictator of weight loss up or down or weight gain. So basically, when you kind of boil it down, the quantity of the food is of the most primary importance. Now, the quality piece is also incredibly important, because one of the things that you realize is the quality of your food in a natural living setting dictates the quantity, if you really think about it. So if you choose to eat, you know, all processed food, if you kind of follow the, if it fits your macros, you know, eat donuts and cake and whatever, as long as it fits a calorie budget, you can do that. But the problem is that quantity of food is typically so small because those things are so energy dense. So you get a small serving and it's like 1,000 calories, and you're going to be hungry because the volume, the satiety is just off. Now, if you if you kind of look at the quality of the food, it's a lot of times the quality will control the quantity. So if you eat more kind of nutrient dense, high volume, high protein, kind of low calorie-ish foods, things like, you know, vegetables, chicken, starches like sweet potatoes or normal potatoes, your likelihood of overeating on the quantity piece is a lot lower. Now, that being said, you can gain weight on the quote unquote clean foods because, I mean, if you're putting 4 or 5 tablespoons of coconut oil in your coffee, you're cooking your vegetables and, you know, a stick of butter, all of a sudden now you've kind of violated some of those concepts. So that's kind of the breakdown. The other thing that's important about food quality is the health properties, right? If you're eating, if you're kind of following the, it's only the calories that matter, right? You're missing a lot of micronutrients, you're missing fiber, a lot of those things that are really beneficial in the long-term game of your health.
Yeah, well said. And you brought up something that I think is one of the biggest lessons that I've learned, just a very practical lesson. I'd love for you to explain it a bit more. You talked about the volume of food and satiety. For instance, potato chips. Most of us, if we got an appetite, down an entire bag, no problem, and still be like, you know what? I'm still hungry. Versus if I have an 8-ounce steak and some greens or a big salad, it's going to be way less calories, but I'm going to feel satiated. I'm going to feel, you know what? I feel good. I don't need to eat more. And what you said was the quality typically dictates the quantity that you eat. I would love to hear, is that because of the volume of food? And also, not to dive too into the fringe, but what about what I read a long time ago with Fast Food Nation and the chemical, the guys on the New Jersey Turnpike, the food chemist,
yep,
manipulating food to make it more hyper? Can you talk about the volume of food and the hyper palatability?
Yeah, so this is a great example, right? If you have a bag of potato chips, there's a lot of things that will cause you to A, eat too much, and B, not feel full. So basically what you've done is potato chips are designed to be as appealing as possible, right? We know that there's things like salt, texture, things that are crunchy, and things that have, you know, fat to them. Fat's a mouthfeel thing. Salt is a taste thing, and crunchy is also a mouthfeel thing. So when you kind of put those all together, you're going to keep eating long after you've kind of hit your full point, right? It's kind of like you eat dinner, you're stuffed, somebody brings out a bowl of Brussels sprouts, you're going to pass, someone brings out a brownie, you're going to eat it, just because that hedonistic reward of eating more food causes you to want to eat more even if you're not hungry. So potato chips are basically specifically designed for you to eat a lot. Now, the reason that you can do that is one, that the tastiness of the food kind of overrides the regulatory mechanisms of hunger in your brain. I mean, the other thing is there's not a lot of fiber, there's not a lot of protein, and they don't take up as much space volume in your stomach because, you know, stretching of your stomach is also a signal. So those are reasons. Now, the reasons that the things like the meal you described are more satiating and more long-term satiating is we know protein has effects on satiety. And then you've got things with some fiber, and you've also got just a larger volume of food that's going to be in your stomach that has to mechanically be broken down. That kind of also signals hunger. So it's kind of like the perfect storm in the bag of potato chips.
Yeah, that's great. And like you said, that crunchy / fat flavored and the saltiness that just, it just is irresistible for some of us. I like ice cream more. I like potato chips too, but my jam is really, man, ice cream. And
you and me both.
Oh yeah. What's your favorite flavor?
Oh man, I've gotten to the point where I judge a brand based on its vanilla because that can tell you like how crafty the brand is and how much they actually care about the basics. But
that's
probably my favorite flavor is usually like a mint chocolate chip.
Ooh, mint chocolate chip is good. Absolutely.
Yeah. There's a really good book that kind of talks about some of these concepts, kind of the potato chip concept. It's called Salt, Sugar, Fat. It's a good, fairly common read that kind of talks about, you know, the food environment that was kind of brought up in the 70s and all sorts of stuff of, you know, how potato chips are designed, how Doritos are designed, and kind of stuff like that. It's a really interesting book to read, and kind of also gives you some good history on obesity research, which is kind of cool too.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I'll put that in the show notes. Definitely pick that up, because the more we understand about our environment, like you said, Brad, the food environment is so incredibly, it has such a big impact on our behavior, and we like to blame endocrine disrupting chemicals and the GMOs and the other things. But a lot of times it's these other things that are really going on. And that's what I try to do here, man. I try to cut through the hype, the nonsense, which is definitely not, if I was selling like, you know, the hormone, $1,000 hormone panel and the, you know, the GMOs all make us fat and just eat my special foods that I sell for you at a, you know, premium price, it would be a lot better for business. But I want to get the truth out to people. I want people to be happier, healthier, to live a legendary life. So no, this is killer stuff, man.
Yeah. You know, and I think that's one of the big things is trying to get the truth out to people is really kind of our job as practitioners and as the professionals. And that's something I try to take pretty seriously.
Yeah. I would love to have you back on to talk more about like optimizing health and performance, but I love where we're going right now with just laying the foundations. And I know this is going to hurt some feelings too, because it's not what people want to hear, man. You want to hear the evil corporations. It's not sexy. You can't blame the evil corporations for it. Well, somewhat, right? The Dorito makers, but nobody thinks, Doritos, health food, Whole Foods. No, nobody's thinking that. But now let's get into, I'd love to talk about the fringes, right? You're a guy who does research, who's done plenty of research, who reads plenty of research. And we talked earlier about a mutual acquaintance who's really on the fringes. And I'd love to hear from you, from your perspective, what are some of the more fringier things that might be worth experimenting with, even though they don't have a ton of science backing them at the moment?
Yeah, I think probably there's two areas I think that are interesting, but I don't know how applicable they are to the average person. I think one is pushing the high end of human performance. We're starting to get some really interesting data of, you know, what the body is capable of and how we can use, you know, things like exogenous supplementation. We can use environmental stressors to kind of adapt bodies for super physiological responses to really kind of push the top end performance. And those are really super interesting areas. The other one is longevity, right? And how do we live longer and how do we live better longer? I think probably the second one is more applicable to the average person. And there's kind of two areas of research going on. Is one is how do we kind of manipulate our daily habits of exercise, sleep, and nutrition to kind of push our lifespan up 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And some of the areas that are involved in those are calorie restriction, because there's some data to suggest that calorie restriction can increase longevity in specific animals. We don't have a lot of good data in humans yet, but I think there's some interesting principles of things like, you know, fasting or protein restriction and things like that, that I think it's going to take probably 20, 30, 40 years to flesh that research out. But that's something I'm going to kind of keep my thumb on, because I think it's super interesting. I mean, how we actually apply that to everyday life is going to be super interesting. But the other one is just the longevity of the human species from a biotechnology standpoint. This is going to get super fringe, Ted. So I hope you don't mind me using a few areas. So one is just the hardcore biological technology of either super physiological doses of supplements or things like genetic engineering. That's super interesting. Or even just like biologicals, like, you know, just hormone replacements and stuff like that. But the super interesting stuff is the nanotechnology that's slowly coming out. Somebody just won a Nobel Prize for basically microscopic molecular machinery. And can we go in and repair damage to the human body as it's done? I think that's going to be, if you want to be on the kind of the very, very forefront and think really ahead of the game, that's going to be super cool. And that's where I think the most interesting stuff is.
How far away is that?
Here's my rule of thumb. So being somebody who works in a lab, you have a very different perspective on advances. So if you hear somebody in the media say like, oh, it's 15 years away, at least double, maybe triple it, just because lab work is, it's a nightmare. Things always go wrong. It never works the first, second, or third time. So I'd say probably we're probably 30 to 40 years from that kind of technology.
Yeah. Okay. So hang in there, everyone. So let's talk a little bit about calorie restriction, protein restriction. In fact, someone asked me this question and I asked you during our first conversation, which was not recorded, but I'd love to go over it here. And he asked me, hey, Ted, what do you think about protein fasting? I was like, what do you mean? Where you eat only protein and nothing else? I don't know, but sign me up. But what he meant was protein restriction because of its effects on IGF, on, I guess, the potential for IGF to cause cancers to grow. Can you talk a little bit? You answered that question. Can you answer it again and go over the details a little bit?
Yeah. So basically, we'll kind of start at the basic principle is there's this idea that the hormone insulin, like growth factor one, we call IGF-1, is something that kind of accelerates aging and can cause cancer. That's kind of the basic premise. And we know that in animals and stuff like that, that if you kind of reduce IGF-1, you get longer lifespans. Now, the amount that is, it's a pretty small amount. It's not like you're going to live, if we were to translate into humans, it's not like you're going to go from living 75 to 105. It might be like 75 to 80. Now, that idea translating into humans is if we restrict dietary protein or if we fast, we can reduce circulating levels of IGF-1, and that should, in theory, increase longevity. Now, the data in humans doesn't really support that at this point. We don't have anything that suggests that it's actually going to lead to longer lifespans. And there's also some potential drawbacks, right? We've got to remember that, let's say you live to 80, but because you've been on a protein-restricted diet, you have lower muscle mass, you have lower bone density because carrying muscle mass and allowing your body to do more work gives you bone density over a longer period of time. So we've always got to balance the one outcome with the other. So I think the idea of modified, you know, fasting or protein restriction for longevity might have some clues and some hints of how to live longer, but I don't really know if it's the best viable option due to all the potential drawbacks from it.
Do you want to live a little bit longer and be weak and have brittle bones, or do you want to potentially live a little bit less and have a super awesome quality of life because you lift? Yeah.
And eat a steak every once in a while, right?
Ooh, I mean, steak is good.
If you don't get to eat steak, it's like, I don't even know why I'm getting out of bed.
Absolutely, man. And you mentioned something about super physiological doses of supplements. My ears and probably the ears of many listeners peaked up when you said that. Okay. You know what I think we'll do is we'll have you back on if you're down for it, and we'll like do in like a health and performance, you know, health, mental, and physical performance optimization podcast. Would you be down for that?
Yeah, that'd be awesome. That would be a ton of fun.
Yeah, because I immediately think of someone like you, and I think you and I are at least similar in the way like we got into this to like become the best, most badass, healthiest human beings we can, because if you've got your genetics, great, but what can we do with this body to make it even better to enjoy our lives more, right?
Yeah, that'd be an awesome topic. I think we're definitely starting to get to the place where a lot more people are having those ideas. And I think the answers to those problems are a lot more simple and straightforward than people think. So I think that'd be a perfect discussion to have.
All right, let's do that. How about this? Let's finish off with, if you got a few more minutes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's finish off with some, maybe your top two or three things that are going around in the fitness / health / biohacking / physical mental performance optimization group where you're like, that is just a waste of your time. That's just someone taking your money, and don't give your money to them.
Oh, yeah. Let me think of my top two. I got to think about this for a second. I would say, you know, people who sell you any sort of supplement, doesn't really matter what it is, with the tagline of this is going to fix your problem, is one of those things just be wary of. There is As of today, there's nothing on the market that is going to make any substantial difference in your training, nutrition program, or your life in general. There's a few ones that will definitely be helpful, but there's nothing that you can base success or results around. I'd say that's probably the first one. I know that's a little bit more broad sweeping and probably covers a lot of ground, but probably the second one is a lot of people are starting to talk about diet and genetics of like, oh, if you've got this
nutrigenomics. Yeah.
Nutrigenomics is the word. Yeah. That is basically what we know right now. If anybody sells you anything based on nutrigenomics, they're full of it. We don't know enough. We really don't even have a beginning basis to understand how that works because gene and nutrient interactions are so complex, and there's nothing out there that you can base a decision on in a human being other than things like, you know, we've got things like phenylketonuria where you can't process phenylalanine and it's called the maple syrup disease, but there's nothing out there that's like, oh, we've got, you know, this genotype, you should only eat 25% of your diet in carbohydrates to maximize fat loss. We have nothing like that. So anybody who tries to sell you something like that is a shill and stay away from them.
Yeah, no, great answer. So what I say about supplements is that they're great after you have your sleep, your nutrition, and your exercise dialed in. But if you don't have that, then absolutely don't waste your time. And the nutrigenomics is something I asked you about as well. And it's so great to hear you say that because about 10 years ago, I actually wrote an article on it because I thought it was going to be such a big deal when I was studying biology. And it turns out it's just opened up a whole nother can of worms with, you mentioned the genotype, which is your genes, the genes you're born with. Your phenotype is the expression of those genes. And then the epigenetic factors, the lifestyle, the environmental things that turn your genes on and off, make it a very complex topic. So we're nowhere near getting, so just stay away from nutrigenomic. Anybody selling, so should we get our 23andMe? How about that?
Yeah, the 23andMe is super interesting in that I think the most interesting piece is the ancestry data, right? Really getting a good idea of who you are and where you're from is super cool. I think there's some really interesting things that you can learn in there, like your ApoE profile. I think there's a few other things that are interesting, but there's not a whole lot we can act on right now other than the ancestry data, which I think is super cool.
What about if you're a fast metabolizer of caffeine or slow metabolizer?
Is that in there? Is that in the 23andMe? I haven't seen the updated release.
I was listening to a podcast and the guy said it was, and I have not done my 23andMe because I've been a bit skeptical about the whole thing to begin with. Well, Brad, I could easily talk to you for another couple hours to get all the details about optimal human health and differentiating between what we should listen to out there and what we should stay away from. But we'll have to do a round two where we have you come back and get deeper into those subjects.
Absolutely, man. Anytime. I'm always up for a good conversation. So you just let me know and we'll dial it up.
Sounds great. So where should people go to learn more about you? I know you have sciencedrivennutrition.com, correct?
Yeah, so that's the main outlet of where people can find most of my, you know, my work. I prefer the long form content. I think a lot of times really learning about something kind of takes a little bit more focused read than the random tweet. So I don't do much tweeting or stuff like that. So you can find most of my stuff on sciencedrivennutrition.com. All of my kind of coaching I do is through Eat to Perform. So that's kind of the avenue where I work with people and do things like that. But you can email me, you can find me on Facebook and send me a message or anything like that. I'm always open and up for conversations about pretty much anything. Even if you guys have ideas that are very contrary to mine, I'm always up for good discussion and lively debate. So,
and that's what we love about you, Brad, because we can actually have a conversation about this stuff instead of what happens, at least on Facebook, where things just degenerate into insulting each other. So really appreciate that about you. So if you are interested, if you're listening right now, if you'd like to get your nutrition handle. Brad is a solid guy to go to. So check out his articles on sciencedrivennutrition.com. And if you'd like to connect with him for perhaps coaching, go to eat2perform.com, and that's where you can hit him up there for coaching. So Brad, thanks again, man. It's a pleasure finally sitting down and getting to talk with you more, and I can't wait to do it again.
Absolutely, Ted. It was a blast and a pleasure, and I'll be excited to continue our work in the future.
Boom.